This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, September 27th, 2005. So what were two undercover British soldiers up to in Basra? Asked the Independent on Sunday, September 25th, 1 week after a dramatic special rescue of the two British soldiers from an Iraqi police station. This exposed hidden tensions and highlighted increasing dangers for British troops, wrote Raymond Whittaker in London and Sarah Tajal Dave in Basra in The Independent. Let's go back and look at what actually happened in Basra and what is the significance of these events. To really understand the answer to the Independent's question of, so what were two undercover British soldiers up to in Basra? Today on Taking Aim, Caught in the Act, Stage Terror in Iraq. First, let's look at the news reports that came out Monday, September 19th, and this one from the Chinese news service Xinhua Net. Baghdad, September 19th. Iraqi police detained two British soldiers in Basra. Iraqi police, states the Chinese news report, detained two British soldiers in civilian clothes in the southern city Basra for firing on a police station on Monday, police said. Quote, two persons wearing Arab uniforms opened fire at a police station in Basra. Actually, it was a patrol. A police patrol followed the attackers and captured them to discover they were two British soldiers, an Interior Ministry source told Xinhua. The two soldiers were using a civilian car packed with explosives, the source said. He added that the two were being interrogated in the police headquarters of Basra. The British forces informed the Iraqi authorities that the two soldiers were performing an official duty, the source said. British military authorities said they could not confirm the incident, but investigations were underway. What were two undercover British soldiers up to in Basra? Ralph?
Al Jazeera carried reports, Maya, on the 19th of September, and it's instructive that these reports that emerged from Xinhua and from China View and from Al Jazeera, when they're replicated in the Western press, key elements are omitted. Al Jazeera. Before the two British Special Forces men were freed by force on Monday, the men were driving a booby-trapped car around Basra loaded with ammunition and explosives. The unrest in Basra was motivated by the perception that the two British soldiers were planning to detonate the explosive-packed car in the center of Basra. Here is the member of the Iraqi National Assembly, Fatah al-Sheikh, from Baghdad. There have been indiscriminate arrests, the most recent of which was the arrest of Sheikh Ahmad al-Farkuzi and two Basra citizens on the pretext that they had carried out terrorist operations to kill U.S. soldiers, a baseless claim. This was confirmed to us by the Second Secretary of the British Embassy in Baghdad. He said that there is evidence on this, and we say, you come up with the evidence before you do the arrest. What are you doing here? In particular, we want to know when the Sons of Basra caught two non-Iraqis who were Britons and in the car of the Cressida type, in a booby-trapped car laden with explosives and ammunition that were intended to explode in the center of the city of Basra in the popular market, what are we experiencing? The Sons of the City of Basra arrested them, and these two non-Iraqis fired at the people and killed them. The two arrested persons are at the intelligence department in Basra, held by the National Guard. But the British occupation forces are attempting to absolve them of any crime. That was Fatah al-Sheikh of the National Assembly and the deputy for Basra, prior to 10 British tanks and a helicopter attack vehicles assaulting the Iraqi police station.
Ralph, let's go through the chronology. On the morning of September 19th, this is Monday morning, over a week ago, two British soldiers dressed in typical Iraqi garb, not westernized clothing, but in the Arab guard, including robes and headgear.
Jalabis and headdress. And
also wigs, so that they would have dark hair and they had beards. These two British soldiers in their Toyota Cressida driving around Basra pass a police checkpoint. They are stopped by the Basra police, and these are police who are trained by the British. The British have complete hegemony in Basra, a city of 1.5 million people. They are stopped at the checkpoint. They are asked who they are, and they say, supposedly, according to Iraqi witnesses, contact our commanders. They refuse to identify themselves. It is known that they are not Iraqis, that they are in disguise. And what ensues is a gunfight. One Iraqi policeman is murdered and another wounded. Other Iraqi policemen arrest the two British, take them to the Jamiat police station, that is the central police headquarters in Basra, where the intelligence services of the Basra police operate. On the way there, the British hear about it, and Brigadier John Lorimar, the commander of the 12th Mechanized Brigade, the head British forces in Basra, sends several armored vehicles. Now, these are not small tanks. These are 28-ton vehicles, massive protected armored vehicles, to the police station. The Iraqi police are incensed. They go through Basra with loudspeakers and tell the population to come to the Jamiat police station. At the police station, so too come reporters. And we have televised on Iraqi TV the reaction of the populace. But not only that, the TV, Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya come to the police station and through satellite throughout the Arab world and also in the Western world, you have televised the following, according to Reuters, September 20th in their report. Two undercover soldiers who had been captured in Basra appeared nervous in television footage of their detention, which showed their wigs, the Arab headdresses, the weapons apparently used in their mission. The tired, unshaven pair were shown seated beside the disguises, an anti-tank missile, other weapons, and communications equipment on Iraqi state television footage. One of these soldiers, who appeared to be in his 30s, had spots of blood on his white T-shirt. At one point, his comrade, wearing a blue T-shirt, put on one of the thick black wigs and a headdress lying on a table, apparently at the instruction of a policeman. The images of the soldiers could hurt British efforts to maintain a low-profile approach to security in Basra, noted Reuters. The pair sat forward in their chairs as police discussed the events that led to their detention. It was also noted that the pair had electronic positioning devices and a medical kit that they had was searched, and the police thought that a bomb could have been inside. They were that wary of these British undercover policemen. What happened next after the televised images of these two British forces, Special Operations Forces? The Iraqi people surrounding the armored vehicles started attacking them with gas bombs, you know, petrol bombs, and the British soldiers were forced to flee. Brigadier John Lorimar, the 12th Mechanized Brigade, took further action. And as Ralph mentioned, send 10 more armored vehicles and attack helicopters and attacked the Iraqi police station. Ralph.
It didn't help when on television, and as reported by Reuters, one of these British undercover operatives joked that he was a Shiite descendant of Islam's prophet Muhammad. It was very apparent that the staged operation of the British follows a pattern. But what we have here in response, and indeed as we look carefully at the way this was reported, as you say, Maya, British forces used 10 tanks supported by helicopters, smashed through the walls of the jail, and the British undercover soldiers were again identified and shown to be traveling in a car that was loaded with explosives. The obvious assumption was that this was a terror operation in which the British were preparing to carry out a staged terror operation, detonating explosives conceivably in the center of the town, which would then be imputed to the Iraqi resistance. What is the response as described by the Scotland on Sunday the 25th? Scrap the Basra police and start again, orders Ministry of Defense. Defense Secretary John Reid is planning to scrap the 25,000-strong police force in southern Iraq and replace it with a new military-style unit capable of maintaining law and order. Reid ordered a root-and-branch review of security in the troubled province following last week's disastrous clashes between British troops and Iraqi police. The violence has led to the scrapping of a detailed plan that could have seen UK forces withdrawn by May next year. Instead, it now seems certain that Prime Minister Tony Blair will have to keep British troops in the country until 2007 at the earliest. The sudden U-turn on Britain's military commitment to Iraq has caused anger and despair in military circles. A former defense chief told Scotland on Sunday that the Iraq expedition has been a colossal political failure. Comments that will pile pressure on Blair over this conflict. General Anthony Walker, former Deputy Chief of Defense, told Scotland on Sunday, "The soldiers should say to the politician, 'F this. We're not going into this conflict until you tell us how you're going to deal with this country once you have won this war.' But they didn't, and they will be a lot longer than anybody planned." So what we're looking at here is a staged operation designed to do what? To implicate the resistance in atrocities, in a false flag operation that is characteristic of the war of occupation in Iraq. Not only is the British operation a standard procedure, but it is the footprint of what the U.S. does itself in the Sunni Triangle.
Ralph, this is a really important story, and we have to go deeper and deeper into it, because the British Ministry of Defense, which is now saying that they're going to scrap the entire Basra police, just the same day, the London Observer had stated that the British were planning a staged pullout from Basra, and we're going to rely upon the Basra police and the Iraqi armed services for their taking over security in Basra. So now we have a complete turnaround. And the British have announced that instead of withdrawing in a year, they will be there, John Reid says, at least until 2007. So let's go into what the British are saying these undercover forces were doing in Basra. Because the Iraqis, who you have mentioned, the minister has said that this was an outrage, particularly the attack on the Iraqi police station to free the two British soldiers. Mohammed Alwali, the governor of the province, said that the raid on the jail was, quote, barbaric, savage, and irresponsible. A British force of more than 10 tanks backed by helicopters attacking the central jail and destroyed it. This is an irresponsible act. This is an understatement for the actual statements that are being communicated by the heads of the Basra government. And remember, this is a government that has been collaborating with the British. So Muhammad Awali, the governor, saying that it's barbaric and savage, the act, the entire Basra officialdom have come out and said that they would not cooperate with the British until there was compensation for what was done to the police station and an apology. But so much for an apology. The Ministry of Defense, as you know, has said it's going to eliminate the entire Basra Police Department. So what are the British saying their undercover agents were doing? And it has been stated by security sources that these undercover soldiers were not mere soldiers, part of the mechanized brigade. In fact, they were part of the Special Reconnaissance Regiment, which we've spoken about in prior Taking Aim programs when we were discussing the London bombings, because the Special Reconnaissance Regiment were involved in the operation which led to the execution of the Brazilian de Menezes. The Special Reconnaissance Regiment, newly formed out of Hereford, is attached to the SAS. This is the Covert Operations Green Berets type unit of the British military that was set up after World War II and does so-called guerrilla operations, that is the covert operations for the British Army. These SRR soldiers in Basra, this is deepening the story, it is alleged that they were working undercover to investigate the Basra police links to the Mahdi army militia. This is the militia of Mukhtar al-Sadr, which has a great deal of intensity of actions and involvement in Basra and dominates much of southern Iraq, according to the Sunday Herald, and controls a great deal of the city's civilian security apparatus. Now, the SRR regiment was trying to look into the infiltration of the city police by the followers of Mukhtar al-Sadr. This is the official story put out by British intelligence. But this does not square with the fact that there were explosives found in the car, or that these undercover agents, not really covert operatives, not undercover agents, fired and assassinated the Basra police. Ralph.
Maya, the article that you're referring to in The Guardian on the 21st of September has the following headline: Softly, softly, army tactics shattered. And the shattering of the army tactics is spelled out. And as you say, Muhammad Awali, the governor of Basra, has now denounced the British Army for a barbaric, savage, and irresponsible raid on the police station. And the response of Brigadier General John Lorimer, commander of British troops, is to claim that it is Iraqi police who are flouting the law in an unacceptable fashion. And they went further and claimed that Iraqi police had turned over the two British operatives to the militia, to the Shia resistance militia, and that therefore the British had to stage their raid to rescue the soldiers from the militia. And of course, all of the visible televised reports show that this is an outright fabrication on the part of Lorimer and the British authorities. There is a relationship between the sequence of events that you describe and this undercover operation, this covert operation here. 25,000 Iraqi police, the official government-sponsored police force of Basra, drawn from the population, with family members, with all their relationships and connections, are obviously affected by the sentiment of the population. However they may be looking for employment, and however they may be recruited as a police force, and however they may be officially sponsored, what is becoming apparent here is that even the official occupation-sponsored coalition government apparatus is incapable of being rendered impervious to the popular sentiment, which is a rage of detestation for the United States and Great Britain and its occupation of Iraq, and a passion for its removal. And how is this manifested? Stephen Vincent, the journalist working for the New York Times, reported that the British authorities were reluctant to interfere in the growing influence of the militia, as it's called, in the police. Why? Because the police themselves are affected by the sentiment of their families, of their neighbors, of their former fellow workers, of the population at large, and were assimilating the hatred for the occupation of which they were themselves designed to be an instrument. So here we have Mr. Vincent abducted and shot dead after he discloses that the police that the authorities have put into place are in fact deeply sympathetic and affected by the anger of the population against the occupation. Who then shot him dead? The authorities would like us to believe that it was the militia who shot Mr. Vincent dead. It's not only Mr. Vincent, who was a journalist working for the New York Times, but a subsequent journalist for the New York Times was shot dead for making similar reports. Fakhr Haider al-Tamimi, 38, who had worked not only for the New York Times, but for The Guardian, and had written an article in which he criticized the British authorities' attitude and approach to the police and their indifference to the fact that the police were no longer a reliable instrument for the occupation. He was shot dead. The question, of course, is, who's doing this murder? And that is illuminated, I think it's fairly clear, by what is being disclosed here about the nature of this British operation with their SAS, SR special forces who were caught in the act in Basra.
Ralph, let's return to the reaction of the Iraqis to this event, because the Iraqis do not accept the British fabrication, the dissimulation. Again, returning to Muhammad Wali about this barbaric, savage, and irresponsible act and the Basra deputy statement. Basra to stop dealing with British forces, as I mentioned before. An article in The Scotsman on the 22nd of September goes into detail about how the Basra government will stop dealing with British forces. On September 21st, the Basra city authorities declared they would no longer cooperate with British forces in southern Iraq. In the Basra provincial city council held an emergency meeting and voted unanimously, quote, to stop dealing with the British forces working in Basra and not to cooperate with them because of their irresponsible aggression on a government facility, end of quote. Bakr Salah Jaber, Iraq's interior ministry, said that the two captured SAS soldiers, who actually are SRR, in fact, had not been handed over to militants, that the British commanders were acting on a rumor when they ordered the storming of a police station, and the British had been negotiating with the Iraqis for the handover of the soldiers. The Iraqi police felt that it was important, since there had been a murder of Iraqi policemen, for the Iraqis to maintain control over these soldiers, and the British say that according to Iraqi law, the soldiers are immune and they should have been handed over to the British commanders. Colonel Bill Durham, the chief of staff for multinational forces in Basra, accused militant Shia groups of infiltrating rogue elements, that was his expression, rogue elements into the police in southern Iraq, as Ralph and I mentioned before. And these are from the Mahdi army. Quote, the trick that we have to pull off now with the Iraqi authorities is to identify these elements, to weed them out, and to reinforce the good parts of the Iraqi police service, he told the BBC. Colonel Dunham was backed by Muwafiq al-Rubai, Iraq's national security advisor, who said that insurgent groups had, quote, penetrated the police. And there you have the action of the military defense a few days later to say that it's going to disband the entire Basra police. Again, the Ministry of Defense, it's official fiction. The description that you can find on the Ministry of Defense website, on the internet, latest news, Basra calm after incidents on September 19th, 2005. Basra calm, Basra is not calm when the city authorities say they will no longer cooperate, yet the official fiction is that life is going on just as normal. Brigadier John Lorimer, the commander of the 12th Mechanized Brigade, releases a statement saying that he had, quote, good reason to believe that the lives of the two soldiers were risks, and troops were sent to the area of the Basra near the police station to ensure their safety by providing a cordon. As shown on television, these troops were attacked with firebombs and rockets by a violent and determined crowd. Later in the day, however, I became more concerned about the safety of the two soldiers after we received information that they had been handed over to militant elements. As a result, I took the difficult decision to order entry to the Jamiat police station. By taking this action, we were able to confirm that the soldiers were no longer being held by the IPS. An operation was then mounted to rescue them from a house in Basra. Official fiction, the Iraqis say over and again that the soldiers had not been handed over to militants, that they were under the Iraqi police control. They are outraged by the British sending 10 large armored troops.
Tanks,
28-ton tanks, not like the tanks we think of from World War II. And these attack helicopters destroying the Iraqi police station and then furthermore saying they're going to disband the Iraqi police.
Maya, let's look at this carefully. It's not only that 25,000 police who were handpicked in Basra are now being denounced by those who handpicked them because they are supposed to be sympathetic to the Shia militia and to the population at large. It's not only that the police are shot dead by British undercover agents who are disguised as Iraqi militants. It's not only that the tanks are sent to get these operatives out of Iraqi custody, but the Iraqi police, the police force, intended to subjugate the population on behalf of the occupiers, goes throughout the city of Basra to mobilize the population to come to the station and to defend the Iraqi police and to defend the arrest of these undercover operatives of the British. And when the British send their tanks, the population bombarded the tanks with Molotov cocktails, and the television display, including on Al Jazeera, shows British tanks aflame and a British soldier climbing out of his tank covered in flames from
three British soldiers were injured, one of them seriously, although the British military is making light of the injuries. He was had to be flown out to Great Britain with, and it is reported he has serious injuries. Continue, Ralph.
Well, Maya, the point here is that what we're looking at is, even as Madeleine Halfbright stated, Iraq is coming apart at the seams. What does she mean by that?
It's like Somalia, Ralph.
Yes. What we're looking at here is the ultimate collapse of occupation authority in a subjugated country, when the nominal police are in fact the instruments of liberation, when they identify with the population, when they arrest the agents of the occupier, when they are then demonized by the occupier who has appointed them, and when the British now are in the position of stating all 25,000 police installed by the British are going to be removed. And now, as the Scotland on Sunday reported on the 25th of September, Basra judge says free U.S. troops
UK.
UK troops must be arrested. The article by Tom Martin, an Iraqi judge ordered the arrest of the two British soldiers freed by their colleagues in a dramatic prison raid. Rahib Hassan issued a warrant stating these undercover special operatives are wanted in connection with the deaths of Iraqis, and he warned that these two men face life sentences for deliberately killing Iraqi civilians. Now, look at the British response. You have no authority over our troops. It is illegal to detain our troops. It is illegal to put them on trial. It is illegal to hold them responsible for a murder operation against the Iraqi civilians. It is illegal to detain them when they are found with an explosive-packed car headed for the center of the market of Basra. No, it is not legal to catch the criminals, the occupying powers, in the very act of terrorizing the population. Why, that's illicit. What better expose of the meaning of occupation and the nature of false flag terror sponsored by the authorities themselves to subjugate the population, to turn it into internecine conflict? What do we have to explain, then, the persistent explosion of huge tonnages in the center of civilian areas of the Sunni and Shia populated centers of Iraq, except the occupiers' false flag design to discredit the resistance, to terrorize and demoralize the population, and to further the objectives of splitting Iraq apart?
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Shunman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Caught in the Act, Staged Terror in Iraq. As Ralph was saying, the Basra judge has ordered the arrest of two British soldiers. So this further escalates the confrontation of the Iraqi collaborating forces with the British, with whom they are collaborating, supposedly. Hassan, the judge, by the way, is the judge of the anti-terrorism forces. That's what he's in charge of in Basra. And he also had interviewed the two soldiers. He then came forward. He accused them of killing the Iraqi policeman. There is much evidence that they did, and of wounding the other policeman who had tried to stop them. They're also accused of carrying unlicensed weapons and holding false identification. Now, that's a new piece of information. Not only did they have disguises, wigs, and dressing themselves as Arabs, but they were carrying false identification.
Maya, when I cited the statement by Madeleine Halfbright that Iraq is coming apart at the seams, I think it's worth reminding our listeners, as we have done before on Taking Aim, that Madeleine Halfbright, as the Secretary of State of Bill Clinton...
Madeleine Albright, Ralph. Former Secretary of State during the Clinton administration.
You'll forgive me my little indulgence here, Maya, but it's hard to call her Albright, at least with a straight face. This is the same Secretary of State under the presidency of Bill Clinton who, when confronted on national television about the consequence of the United Nations and the Clinton administration orchestration of the blockade of Iraq, which had cut Iraq off from food and medicine and from vital goods, that the consequence had been the death of 1.5 million civilians at that time, 750,000 children among them. And Diane Sawyer, I believe it was, asked Madeleine Halfbright what was her reaction to that, and she said, it's worth it. It's worth it. Iraq is coming apart at the seams. Here is the report on September 23rd in the Daily Ireland. Basra attack echoes SAS actions in the north of Ireland. The sinister covert operations, writes Jariath Kearney in the Daily Ireland. The sinister covert operations by British forces in Iraq are reminiscent of the activities of the SAS in the north of Ireland, the leading human rights campaigner stated last night. Paul O'Connor of the Derry-based Pat Funikan Center demanded that the British government break the cycle of abuse imposed by its forces. He questioned the sheepish decision by large sections of the media to report the Ministry of Defense line as established fact. Mr. O'Connor, speaking to Daily Ireland after further details emerged about the incidents in Basra on Monday involving undercover British operatives, immediately drew parallels with the March 1988 attack on the funeral of IRA volunteer Coimlin MacBradai. During that incident, two armed and undercover Army intelligence operatives drove directly into the cortege in West Belfast, and the soldiers fired indiscriminately upon the population. In fact, undercover soldiers opened fire even after being stopped and challenged by Iraqi police in Basra, and that indeed is the parallel. For 3 decades, the British forces in Ireland had carried on staged operations in which they were disguised as IRA, carrying out indiscriminate attacks upon the population itself. And indeed, that is the record that is detailed here by the report in the Daily Ireland describing the murders in Belfast of Solicitor Pat Funikane, the former Secretary of State, the activities of the British Special Forces, the operational techniques that are being discussed were used against us. That's what was happening in Ireland. That's the meaning of the British government's Intelligence and Security Commission. That's what they were up to in our country. Brigadier Gordon Kerr, now stationed with the British forces in Iraq, played a key role in the activities of covert British operations in the north of Ireland as commanding officer of the Force Research Joint Unit Joint Services Group. Quote, "It is not surprising, and is in fact for many people reminiscent of the activity of the SAS here, when they are engaged in covert shoot-to-kill missions aimed at the population itself."
Ralph, I just want to correct one thing. Pat Funcane is one of two attorneys, two lawyers. He was a solicitor who were murdered. These are people who were defending IRA militants, and they were murdered by the undercover, the covert operatives, the SAS, in Britain. You were quoting Paul Murphy, who had said many of the operational techniques that would be discussed in the inquiry, that's the inquiry into the murder of Pat Finucane, that the British refused to have. And the reason they said, Murphy said, was many of the operational techniques that would have been discussed in the inquiry would be used currently in the war against terror.
Well, that's exactly why, Maya, you're quite right. The quotations are from Paul O'Connor of the Derry-based Pat Funcane Center, which has been named for Pat Funcane by the center that is exposing and documenting the role of the SAS and the British Special Forces in carrying out terror operations which were imputed to the Irish resistance and to the IRA, but were in fact government operations. And they were not random or isolated incidents, but they were a prevalent pattern in which the British Special Forces, undercover forces, the SAS, were carrying out terror campaigns against the civilian population at large, imputing these to the IRA, and then murdering people within the IRA and imputing these acts to other factions in the IRA in order to instigate internecine disarray and conflict within the Irish resistance movement itself.
Ralph, an article that's on the internet by Sean McMathuna, M-A-T-H-U-N-A, the SAS, their early days in Ireland, and the Wilson plot, referring to Prime Minister Wilson, who was forced to resign. The
Harold Wilson, who I knew, with whom we had a lot of dealings during our years in Great Britain, Harold Wilson was not merely forced to resign. This was, in fact, a British intelligence coup against Harold Wilson, which was systematically operated to discredit him and his government by staging operations that were British intelligence operations without Harold Wilson's knowledge and authority, and in order to compromise his government and to isolate him and to force him out, because the Wilson government was attempting to negotiate a peace settlement in Ireland that would allow for Irish self-determination in some measure. Reformist though it was, the British SAS was not prepared to tolerate this, and particularly because it would have called a halt to the false flag operations that defined the British murder apparatus in Northern Ireland and in the Republic of Ireland and within the Great Britain itself, analogous, as the Daily Ireland has made clear, to precisely the modality of events that are unfolding in Iraq and not only in Basra, as we will mention in a few moments.
And that's why some of this is outlined in Sean McMathuna's brief article, The SAS, Their Early Days in Ireland and the Wilson Plot, which is, in a way, a review of the disinformation presented by Sunday Times journalists James Adams, Robin Morgan, and Anthony Bainbridge of a book they wrote in 1988 entitled Ambush, the War Between the SAS and the IRA, which supposedly is discussing the SAS operations. But as Mathuna and other journalists note, in fact, it contains a lot of disinformation. It's a pro-government approach towards what the SAS was doing in Northern Ireland.
The irony, Maya, is not only was Ambush, which purported to be an expose book, a pseudo book, but even the author that was given to the book, Alexander Plateau, was a pseudonym. And in fact, as you say, Ambush was disinformation. It was intended to anticipate the exposés that were now being published throughout Ireland about the real meaning of the SAS pseudo-terror operations that were really British official terror operations that were being imputed to the Irish Republican Army.
What's interesting about the SAS, and we've seen this in El Salvador and elsewhere in the world, like the Philippines or in Vietnam, is that the SAS teams that have been sent to Oman, Zimbabwe, Brunei, and Kuwait, and we'll discuss more of that in a moment, that they are deployed as, quote, training teams, when in fact they are covert operatives, and they dress up, they engage themselves, they duplicate the look and the activities of the resistance movements in these countries and carry out operations. These are pseudo operations that in the remaining minutes we'll discuss. And this is what took place in Northern Ireland. Not only was there infiltration into the IRA, into the very high levels of the IRA, but there were operations that were carried out supposedly by the IRA, but was exposed by actually SAS officers themselves later to be purely SAS operations.
Yes, a heavily armed 8-man SAS unit was arrested in the Irish Republican south of Armagh. And this was the arrest based upon SA operations in Armagh that involved not only the killing of supporters of the Irish Republican Army and indeed of Irish independence, but a series of murder operations that were the work of British officers and British special forces and the SAS, and always imputed to the IRA itself. And as the Irish article describes, after protracted disinformation campaign against him, Harold Wilson resigned in March 1976, bringing new faces to the top military and political positions in Northern Ireland. Merlin Rees was replaced by Roy Mason and a new army commander, General Timothy Creasy. And they then had a meeting in Oman in the Persian Gulf. Mason is defense secretary. Creasy is commander of the Sultan of Oman's mercenary army, all staffed by SAS officers. They had, in fact, been engaged in precisely such terror operations in the Persian Gulf and in Oman. And after they forced Wilson's resignation, they developed, as the Daily Ireland describes, a new military strategy, backed up by the process of Ulsterization. And indeed, Colin McNutt, a member of the Irish Republican Socialist Party, which was a legal party, was immediately shot dead with this new dispensation. A civilian passerbys were killed in a barrage of over 200 rounds. This was imputed to the IRA. In fact, it was the work of the SAS. This is a very long and detailed revival of the passion of the Irish in exposing the British crimes that were imputed to their own struggle for national independence.
Ralph, to continue with what the British did, an article by Lawrence E. Klein, Pseudo-Operations and Counterinsurgency, Lessons from Other Countries, which is also available on the Internet. And let's look at who, comes out of the U.S. Strategic Studies Institute, connected to the U.S. Army War College. And you can go to the SSI, that's the Strategic Studies Institute, homepage to find the article. And Lawrence E. Klein is an instructor with the Center for Civil Military Relations, Naval Postgraduate School, Monterey, California. He develops national counterterrorism strategy. He's retired U.S. Army military intelligence officer. He worked in El Salvador as an advisor in Lebanon during the Civil War and also during Desert Storm and Somalia, many of these places where you had what are called pseudo-operations, covert operations. So let's look at some of the examples of what the British did in other places.
Well, it's British is only the beginning of the story. Look at the, just take a moment and look at this. This monograph examines the role of pseudo-operations in several foreign counterinsurgency campaigns. Pseudo-operations are those in which government forces are disguised as guerrillas and carry out operations in their name. Pseudo-operations have been applied in every counterinsurgency arena. Now he cites El Salvador. He cites Vietnam. He cites Somalia. He cites the Mau Mau uprising in Kenya. He cites the Selu scouts in southern Rhodesia. Indeed, this is the pattern. What we've been describing as false flag operations, this document goes into particular detail. One interesting thing about it, however, its entire focus is on the British and the French.
And the Portuguese.
And the Portuguese. The only reference to the American role is the role of pseudo-guerrillas during the Huk insurrection in the Philippines from 1946 to 1945.
Except that he doesn't mention the United States. He says that the pseudo-operation was set up by the Philippine constabulary, that is, the Philippine police.
Yeah, force, so what he calls Force X. But in fact, Force X was the operation of the United States authorities themselves. The atrocities that were carried out against the civilian population in the Philippines that were imputed to the Huk Belahop resistance movement to U.S. occupation were of U.S. authorship, U.S. operations entirely.
And one of these operations in, I think it's Rhodesia, where, yes, it is the Rhodesia with the Selya scouts, they conducted operations. They went outside of Rhodesia. They went into Mozambique, Zambia, and Botswana. They would disguise themselves as being part of the neighboring country's forces. And in one of them, 84 scouts using Rhodesian trucks, this took place in 1976, trucks and armored cars painted in Mozambique military camouflage drove directly into a camp. There they killed 1,000 purported guerrillas, he says. This is 84 scouts killing 1,000 people. Militarily, he says, it was a remarkable feat. Unfortunately, the camp was formally registered with the United Nations as a refugee camp. Most of those killed were unarmed, and they were standing in formation for a parade. The camp hospital was set afire by the rounds fired by the scouts, burning alive all the patients. Here we have the Selous scouts, set up by the British, under British auspices, murdering 1,000 people in a refugee camp.
Maya, that's what he describes in El Salvador. As you say, he describes it in Mozambique. More recently, the Salvadorans used pseudo-teams for carrying out their operations. The Turkish government used these special teams called Special Action Teams in operation against the Kurdish Partia Karkar in Kurdistan. This is the standard procedure of the imperial regimen wherever it operates, the false flag operation, the terrorizing of the people in the name of the resistance itself. Fake terror. Here we have an instructive report on the 16th of September. Dar Jamal in Iraq contacted the family of al-Zarqawi in Jordan and got confirming evidence that he is dead. Now, on Taking Aim, we have been reporting for almost 3 years that Abu Musab al-Zarqawi had died from his wounds years ago. In fact, at the time of his death, his official organization in Jordan had described the particulars. First of all, al-Zarqawi had been gravely wounded, causing his left leg to be amputated. He was fitted with a prosthesis. He remained alive and was continuing to carry out his political work in Jordan. When he died of subsequent wounds, everybody had acknowledged that al-Zarqawi was dead, yet the al-Qaeda leader in Iraq is what the United States authorities have ascribed to Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. Washington continues, as this is from Al Jazeera, Washington continues to use him as a boogeyman to justify his prolonged military occupation of Iraq. And here is what a leading Shia cleric stated. Sheikh Jawad al-Khalesi, the imam of the Al-Qasimiyya Mosque in Baghdad, told Le Monde on Friday, September 16th, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi does not exist. He is an invention of the U.S. occupiers to divide our people. Al-Zarqawi was killed, and the U.S.-led war on the country is designed to resurrect him in order to create a rationale for its continued brutality in our country. His family in Jordan held a ceremony after his death, the imam continues, and therefore Abu Musab al-Zarqawi is a ploy used by the Americans to continue this occupation. It is a pretext. He made his comments to Le Monde as he passed through Paris after attending an interreligious gathering in the French city of Lyon, organized by the Roman Catholic San Egidio community, and he stated in an audio message on the internet on Wednesday that the
Ralph, these are the messages that are continually coming out by al-Zarqawi, and that's why the Sheikh al-Khalesi made this statement, because just the other day posted on the internet was another message attributed to al-Zarqawi, which states that the Shia, quote, should find refuge with the Americans rather it was meant to attack the Americans. And the Americans are forever posting these fake messages from al-Zarqawi in the same way as for Osama bin Laden, as an excuse for deepening the military presence and occupation of Iraq. Again, leading back to the British, where they set up a police force, they say now that it is infiltrated by Iraqis who are members of various resistance groups, and consequently they're going to destroy the entire police force.
Well, Maya, our friend Frank Morales, in his article on May 10th, the provocateur state is the CIA behind the Iraqi, quote, insurgents, unquote, and global terrorism, picks up on a theme that we have been developing now for 4 years, and he cites the document that we have referred to often called Proactive Preemptive Operations Group, P2OG, Donald Rumsfeld's Defense Science Board, which is designed and calls for secret missions to carry out terrorist attacks in order to provide a pretext for response. These are, in fact, assassinations, sabotage, secret military operations that will provide for rationale for the United States to carry out operations it has planned for many years. And in particular, there is an article on May 1st, 2005 by Peter Moss of the New York Times Magazine. Two of the top U.S. advisors to Iraqi paramilitary commandos are veterans of U.S. counterinsurgency operations in Latin America. And the article describes what is called the Salvadorization of Iraq. And what it does is to describe the role of James Steele, who led a team of 55 U.S. Army Special Forces in El Salvador during the 1980s, carrying out staged terror operations, which were, in fact, U.S. operations then imputed to the authorities. You can't wash your hands when they're covered in blood, writes Hart Vigas in The Independent on the 24th of September, describing the real meaning of the war of occupation, the real meaning of the terror apparatus of the bourgeois state, the imperial regimen.
Ralph, Hart Vigas became a conscientious objector. He was part of the 82nd Airborne.
That's right, and the description that he makes in The Independent on the 24th of September illuminates the very thesis of this program. I will close with the following important article. Prince Saud al-Faisal, the Saudi foreign minister, stated today that he has been warning the British administration that Iraq was hurtling toward disintegration, a development, he said, was designed to drag the region into war. There is no dynamic now pulling this nation together. All the dynamics are pulling the country apart. He is sending this message to everyone who will listen, he says. You even have the royal family in Saudi Arabia echoing half-bright and sounding the alarm. 25,000 British stooge policemen in Basra are going to be removed because they are immersed in the popular rage against occupation. The handwriting is on the wall. The false flag operation defines the criminal nature of the imperial regime in Iraq, in El Salvador, in Vietnam, and across the world.
This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Caught in the Act, Stage Terror in Iraq, will be on our website, www.takingaim.info, and also on the new WBAI archive at www.wbai.org. You can reach us at Taking Aim at PacBell, that's PACBELL.net. We'll be with you next week.